It was a determined insurgency from a number of people, both in the party room and sort of backed by voices, powerful voices in the media, really to bring, if not bring down the government, certainly bring down my prime ministership.
It's almost a month since Malcolm Turnbull was rolled as the Prime Minister of Australia. But a key question surrounding that tumultuous week remains. Who was pulling the strings?
And yes, I had a view about who I thought should be leading the Liberal Party, and I made that view known.
We have a new Prime Minister in Scott Morrison, but allegations of bullying and discrimination against women are stymieing the Liberal Party's recovery. Former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd has labelled media mogul Rupert Murdoch a cancer on democracy. And just this week, there are claims Mr Murdoch and Seven boss Kerry Stokes were using their newspapers to push their preferred candidates during the spill. It comes at a time when cynicism pervades the state of our politics, media, and ultimately democracy throughout the West. What has caused media and politics to become so polarised? With the left and right in a constant state of war, why has the centre become a radical place to be? From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain, a new weekly podcast where you and I get the full story on some of the most significant issues facing Australia and a look inside the newsrooms that bring them to you. I'm Tori Maguire. This week I sat down with Chief Political Correspondent of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, David Crowe, and Nine's political editor Chris Yuleman to discuss if democracy really is on its deathbed and why the Liberal Party is facing life after the election with as little as five women in Parliament. We'll also hear from former News Corp editor David Pemberthy about how it works between Rupert Murdoch and the editors of his papers. But first, let's go back to the week of the spill. Chris Yuleman had just delivered this bombshell live cross on Nine's Today programme.
Tabloid newspapers around the country. 2GB in Sydney, led by Alan Jones and Ray Hadley, and Sky News in particular, with its evening lineup, are waging a war against the Prime Minister of Australia. Now, that's what they think. That's just reporting the news. Apparently, if you say that to them now, they get their knickers in a huge twist.
It ended with a dire warning for our politicians.
I am really distressed about what I see around the Western world. We're seeing a fracturing of democracies. We're seeing that at a time when we see a rise of a different way of doing business in the world, coming out of China and the USSR. And let's call it, if you like, authoritarian capitalism. There
are now Chris, do you really believe that?
I do think that. I think that the people have lost faith around the Western world. It's not just something that we see here. And the symptoms of it are Trump in the United States, their Brexit, what we're seeing, the movement to the far right in Europe. And the loss of faith, I think, actually begins with the churches. And that's a long-run thing. You know, that started 150 years ago, but it ends with the state. And there are a number of reasons, I think, for that. But part of what we're seeing is a response to globalisation, where that the losers are finally finding their voice, because we always thought that there'd be enough wealth to go around to make everyone a winner. Well, it turns out that wasn't actually the case. The financial crisis, I think, supercharges that sense in people that they're the big losers, and the winners never actually lose, that they just go on doing what they always did. What we've seen is that people aren't reaching up to these supernatural organisations, you know, the European Union, or, you know, even larger states now, they're becoming more tribalised. The other thing that we're seeing with the rise of the internet, which we again thought might be the glue that holds this whole thing together, this is allowing people to ghettoise, to be able to talk to each other in groups of like-minded thought. So I think that you know, there's a whole series of things that are at work, and we're seeing around the Western world a fracturing of politics as we knew it.
David, do you think we've been inoculated from this at all, or do you think it's playing out the same way here that it is around the rest of the world?
It's playing out in a similar way, and it's all about fragmentation. And you can see political leaders appealing to different fragments of the audience. They're all focused on, you know, what each person defines differently as their version of the base. And they're all appealing to this fragmented audience now, and you're getting disengagement because it's looking at some often specialised issues that don't matter much to the wider community. They obsess about an issue that's of great concern to a particular fragmented part of their base, to the neglect of things that are going to matter out in the real world. And they're disengaged from this political class that they don't feel is working for them. And that's what we saw in the leadership spill.
People think it's a sort of Trump phenomenon, but it's not real. He didn't invent this, did he?
No, he's a symptom. He's not actually the cause of all of this. When I went down to visit the Trump voters and at the bottom of West Virginia in Logan County, and you in that society you see something that's completely dysfunctional. So all their coal jobs have gone. You can see the ill health of the people on the streets. In they're overweight. They're taking a lot of drugs. A lot of people with limps and clear social problems. There was nowhere that you could actually eat. If it wasn't McDonald's, it was nowhere else. And they felt, quite genuinely and rightly, that both sides of politics had failed for them. And Trump is a man who offered to break the system. Well, for people who believe the system is already broken for them, they want him to smash the system. And the louder that Washington screams and the louder that the mainstream media screams, the more they believe he's actually doing the job that they sent him to Washington to do. The system's already broken for them, so they're quite happy if he breaks it for everyone else.
There's a parallel in Longman, the Longman by-election, when we went up there to talk to local voters. They're there to be wooed by people who want to come in with a message that's saying, bust up the major parties, they've let you down, they've forgotten about you, register your protest vote now. And that's what some of those voters did. They gave up on the two majors.
And Tory, people seem bemused by the fact that a lot of this is in a sort of white, middle-aged, working-class population. They were the ones who lost their job. The first cry of anger we saw out of that population was the first round of Pauline Hanson, which was off the back of all the changes that Labor had made to the economy, agreed to by the coalition. And now we're seeing it again, but supercharged down the track. It's the same phenomenon. They're the people who feel they've lost.
So do you think democracy itself is under threat?
No, I don't. I think that we're going through a cycle where there's this disengagement, this anger with the mainstream parties. But getting back to, say, the causes of this, the people who are left out by economic change and so forth, I think we'll see that Trump's recipe to fix this problem won't work. You'd have to think that over time, people will see that it's all very well to register a protest vote about the loss of manufacturing jobs. That does not mean the politician who gets your protest vote can actually fix that problem for you.
I fear that it is. You know, that's one of my great worries now, because there are alternatives that are on offer. And one is authoritarian capitalism. We're seeing it coming out of China. You know, Francis Fukuyama famously wrote that the end of history essentially was liberal democracy. Turns out that it's not. There are alternatives on offer. In fact, a lot of our business people seem quite swayed by this idea.
I've spoken all of a sudden looks appealing, doesn't it?
Australian business people keep telling me that the best government in the world is Chinese. And I think that this is a group of business people who don't actually understand where all of their wealth is created, you know, in a civil society that gives them the rule of law, in a civil society that gives them a predictable outcome to the way that they might do business. And in fact, if they were exposed to the way that China can do business completely, they might find it doesn't suit them at all. So I really do fear that there is an alternative on offer at a time when the West is really weak. And we're not certain what our project is anymore. What is it that as a society, as Australians, we can actually all agree on before we start the fight over all the things that we don't agree on?
The fragmentation is also there in the numbers in Parliament. We've had the Gillard government in a minority government. We've had now a wafer-thin majority for the coalition under Malcolm Turnbull after 2016. So a lot depends on the result of the next election, the size of a majority one way or the other, whether that brings some stability and whether that enables the government, whichever one it is in the next term, to actually assert some authority and to demonstrate some stability. I often think about the late 60s in Australia as a time where we also saw incredible instability in a coalition government in the wake of the Menzies era. That didn't last forever. That time of leadership turmoil, of backlash from the electorate, it all comes down to the majority in Parliament and a government's ability to deliver on a mandate and have some kind of vision.
Are there some issues that's just impossible? I mean, we keep losing prime ministers over energy policy. Why is energy policy sort of the ground zero for politics of the extreme in this country?
Yeah, look, I think that Australian politics broke at the end of 2009, where Malcolm Turnbull was trying desperately to get the coalition to sign up to Kevin Rudd's carbon pollution reduction scheme. And he lost, remember, by a single vote in his party room in doing that. And never forget that it was essentially an alliance between the extreme right of politics, led by Barnaby Joyce, and the extreme left of politics led by Bob Brown that both opposed that solution. Bob Brown famously said, we would lock in failure. Well, look what we've done. And we've seen the same forces at work opposing almost every compromise ever since. The last one was the National Energy Guarantee. It was opposed by Greenpeace and the Greens, and it was opposed by Barnaby Joyce and Tony Abbott. So that was the point at which I feel that politics fractured, and it introduced a character into Australian politics who has been the dominant figure ever since, and that's Tony Abbott. And Tony Abbott's style of politics is to break things and not make them. Now, he, you know, for better or for worse, has imposed on Australian politics a way of doing business, which I believe has done nothing to progress our society.
People voted for him, though.
Absolutely, they did. And, you know, they voted, or did they vote against what they saw as the dysfunction and disunity in the Labor Party?
Look, maybe they did. But then when, you know, he was knocked off by Malcolm Turnbull, Malcolm Turnbull then lost 18 seats. He picked up one, but he lost. People were voting for Tony Abbott.
But on energy, people have waxed and waned on how much needs to be done. You know, you ask people, do you want to stay in the Paris Climate Agreement? And they generally say yes. Obviously, at the same time, they're also worried about their energy bills. And you've got this situation in the community where it's very easy for people to convey a negative message, to play on fears about electricity bills, to blow up concerns about the Paris Agreement. And that's what we've seen, this waxing and waning of views on energy over a decade now. I think it's still going to be very difficult in the next term of Parliament, because some of the same structural factors that made the National Energy Guarantee so difficult to achieve, for instance, because it needed the agreement of the states, that's still going to play out. And we may get Liberal state governments that don't want to sign up to something that a Labor federal government tries to achieve.
But if you're talking about the style of politics, and we did see that the Labor Party was playing games on the National Energy Guarantee all the way through, and the Labor states were playing games, and they were the games of opposition, they were the games that Tony Abbott was very good at playing, we might find ourselves in the circumstance with which I will expect where we'll land, was we get a Labor government which will introduce into Parliament the National Energy Guarantee, which was championed by Josh Frydenberg. Will Tony Abbott allow the Liberal Party to vote for something like that? Because what we need in the end on this is some sort of bipartisan agreement. We can't keep continuing in a circumstance where we have absolutely no certainty for investment. And that's what this is designed to set up. Now, it's not the best or the second best or maybe even the third best option. It's just the only option we've got on the table. And at some point, we need compromise.
So what about the so-called culture wars? Do you think that people in the electorate care about these issues that seem to take up so much attention in the media and politics discussion about the country?
No, I don't. I think that one of the big problems in Canberra at the moment is the self-indulgence of federal politicians with issues that are not important enough out in the wider community. For instance, this week there was a bit of a debate within the coalition party room on the issue of vaping, electronic cigarettes and so forth. Now, I can see why you might have an argument about whether that should be legalised and so forth, like it is in the United States. But it's a secondary, maybe less than secondary issue. And I think we've seen a lot of that, whether that is 18C, for instance, not as big an issue out in the community as it was within the Liberal Party room. That's definitely a problem where, again, they're playing to this fragmented audience and playing to their own base and forgetting about the wider community.
Yeah, and I don't want us to forget either that these problems exist on the far left and the far right. We've seen some of the debates that are now being driven in universities where people are so precious. They can't stand to hear an opinion that's different from the one that they hold themselves. They need trigger warnings so that they can be told whether or not they're going to hear something offensive coming up. They're blowing people off campuses simply because they don't agree with their worldview. So it's on both sides of politics. And the problem that we've got is debates being driven by the extremes, and the place of combat is usually social media. So these two groups only come together to yell at each other across this divide. And, you know, I think now the whole world's become a broadcaster. And guess what? Turns out they're much worse than we ever were. Well, once upon a time used to go and have to talk and apologise to the media. And now I can say, look, you're all in it and you're all awful and you're making us worse.
So speaking of making us worse, let's go to your claims of media figures bullying in the Liberal Party. Do you still think that's what happened in that week?
I think it's transparently the case. And you can make the argument quite rightly that publishers have always been in the business of pushing their case pretty hard. So, you know, you go back to the days of Frank Packer, and he used his enterprise absolutely to help bring down John Gorton. It's happened in the past. So that is the way that publishers use powerful media organisations. So we shouldn't be surprised by that. And we've certainly seen that that was the case now, that that Kerry Stokes and Rupert Murdoch were having a fairly vigorous discussion about who should be Prime Minister of Australia. Okay, so that's not news, but it is certainly part of the story that they were having a hand in this debate and trying to force it one way or the other. Then there's the new phenomenon, like the tip of the spear of News Corporation now is Sky News. And I do make the distinction, because I think that, you know, David Spears and Laura Jays and Kieran Gilbert are doing a magnificent job on, and I think that it plays a very worthy role. However, and they'll say they're commentators, they're not journalists, so they can say whatever they like. But if you get to the point where you are actually making phone calls, where you are trying to intervene, well, you're not just a commentator, you're actually a lobbyist. And all I was saying is, I think that should be transparent.
The only person who's actually said that they did do that was Alan Jones. Do you think, David, that there, you know, there is a difference between journalism and commentary and activism, and that there's a place for each of them?
I think there's a difference. I think there is a place for each of them. This is a free media society. Commentary, it's all fair go, but fair game. But we did see that that was a factor in a leadership spill. That's hugely important. It's part of the news about what happened in that mad fortnight. That fortnight coinciding with the fact that Rupert Murdoch was visiting Australia. It coincided with meetings between Rupert Murdoch and some of the staff across that corporation. And it was a factor. Malcolm Turnbull called out, you know, the pressure that was being applied from outside the parliament, and it's becoming clearer day by day what was going on.
How big a factor, though?
It's taken effect over a length of time. For instance, Sky News at night, when it has commentators like Peter Credlin on, they have fueled the instability against Malcolm Turnbull. They have blown up issues like the Monash Forum on coal-fired power stations, and made that out to be a backbench revolt when there might have been 5, 7, maybe 10 MPs behind it. So it's all a matter of fueling that instability over a length of period. And I think that did have an impact on weakening a prime minister.
Yeah, and I understand the business model, and it actually, people say that not many people listen to it. In fact, of the programs that rate, the ones that rate on Sky, and their ratings are on the rise, ones that rate are the ones that are involved in fairly significant commentary. So, you know, good luck to them. That's their model. I'm kind of not sure what Rupert Murdoch sees the business model as now, because if you think that was Fox News, which is now being replicated in Australia, well, the effect of that organisation, I'd say, on the Republican Party in the United States would be to absolutely fracture it. And it would appear to me that that's part of the effect that Sky is having on the base of the coalition. Now, I don't understand why people in the coalition would think that's a good thing. One of the things that keeps striking me is that Tony Abbott's spiritual godfather, essentially, is Bob Santa Maria. What did Bob Santa Maria do to the Labor Party? Well, he made it unelectable for 23 years.
Right.
And I think that some of that effect may well be felt inside the coalition.
Again, it gets back to this splintering of the base, because MPs are so, Liberal MPs, are so worried about this core part of the party that pays close attention to the agenda as set out on Sky News and in other media. And they're so worried about those members of their party that it's making it very difficult for them to reach out to a wider community and to, in fact, increase membership. We're seeing this happening with a party. Liberal Party's not the only party that's seeing a decline in membership, but that's absolutely a factor as well.
And just to interpolate one point here, the thing I find most extraordinary about all this is that this is an organisation, it's not the only organisation, 2GB does as well, same business model, is to basically spend all morning or all night shouting at everybody else. We're just simply making an observation that they're having an effect. They want to have an effect, because there's no point talking unless you've got power, and they clearly have some, they're having an effect. And they get hysterically angry when you mention it.
They want to deny.
No, I just don't get it. It's like, we're simply doing, for a brief period of time, what is your entire business model? And we're simply saying, go have a look at it. Either what we're saying is true or not true, but have a watch, make up your own mind.
So what do we do? How do we get everything back on track? Because we don't seem able to keep a prime minister for long enough to have any meaningful reform, which is one symptom of everything that we've been talking about.
Well, just to talk about, you know, mechanisms, I think there's a very good argument for the Liberal Party having a look at the rules they have around leadership. We have seen more stability on leadership on the Labor side. That's partly because lessons were learned from the past. It's also because there's a structural reason for that stability. Now, there are lots of arguments about whether you need those rules, and also there are arguments about how a Labor caucus could overturn those rules. But the fact is, they've had stability, and I think we're now seeing a dynamic play out in the electorate where stability is rewarded and instability is punished. The coalition will have to learn those lessons.
I think the road back's very difficult. I mean, you think about it in your own life. If you lose faith in someone for something that they've done, getting that faith back, particularly at the level where it began, if you feel that you've been betrayed, is an extremely difficult thing to do. And this is something the Catholic Church is going through now. And you could not have a more profound loss of faith than you've seen in the Catholic Church in what was essentially a spiritual betrayal of the people it was supposed to be leading. I think that something profound has happened in Australian politics. We've seen over the course since Kevin Rudd was in, 84% of the population then thought that federal politics was in reasonably good shape. It's 41% now, less than half. People between the ages of 18 and 39, not, you know, a significant number of them now don't think that democracy is necessarily the best form of government. I think these are extremely...
How much do they know about the other forms of government,
exactly,
though?
Exactly.
Well, they don't remember what communism meant, yep, or what a communist central command economy was.
The alternatives are worse.
After a break, we'll come back to look at the Liberal Party's woman problem. But first, a quick chat with David Pemberthy, who I worked for when he was editor of News Corp's Daily Telegraph, about how much Mr Murdoch directs the editorial line of his newspapers. So when you were editor of the Daily Telegraph, how much political direction did you get from Rupert Murdoch?
I got absolutely zero from Rupert Murdoch. I would have had dozens of meetings with him, usually alongside our former chief executive, John Hardigan, and often in a group setting with other editors. And obviously, Rupert is a person who is very interested in politics. He's very interested in how politics affects his readers. And we had many and varied discussions around politics and about the different qualities of different politicians, the different policies of different political parties. But I think that the stuff that is being said and written at the moment is completely ill-informed. I was editor of the Telegraph for 4 years almost, from 05 to 09, or 05 to 08. And that period overlapped with the final years of John Howard and the elevation of Kevin Rudd at the 2007 election. And anyone who's trying to paint this picture that Rupert Murdoch is sort of wholly beholden to the conservative side of politics should go through my back catalogue, because we did several front pages in the lead-up to the 2007 election that were devastating for John Howard.
So how did you decide to do that?
We did it by just having by listening to our audience, by listening to our own readers. And we could tell at the start of 2007, for a whole bunch of reasons, one of them being work choices. You know, ironically, you know, Rupert Murdoch might be someone who strongly supports a deregulated industrial system. But equally, we knew that our readers felt that Howard had overstepped the mark with work choices. You know, and Rupert Murdoch, in any of the discussions that I ever had with him, he never said, you have to do this, you have to do that. We had discussions around the feedback we were getting through our letters page, the feedback we were getting through our online readers' discussions. Most importantly, though, it was the analysis of our reporters on the ground based on the inside knowledge we had from our conversations with politicians. I had the world's shortest conversation with Rupert Murdoch in 2007, where he came into my office with Hardo a couple of months before the election, and he said, who do you think you're going to back? And I said, well, I reckon we're going to back Rudd, because it's not like our readers hate Howard. They generally think Howard's been a good prime minister. They simply think that he's run his race. And, you know, the problem was you had the very poorly handled tensions with Peter Costello over the leadership. It got to the point, and this had just happened that night when I was talking to Rupert Murdoch, that John Howard had said, all right, I promise that if I'm elected, I will quit halfway through the term. And I said to Rupert Murdoch, I don't see how you can run promising to quit. And he said, yeah, it's a bit of a mess, isn't it? And then he said, let's hope the new guy doesn't mess things up.
Everyone's talking about the fact that Rupert Murdoch was here the week of the spill. Is there a different energy in the News Corp newsrooms when Murdoch is here? Like, do the editors feel like they need to be more of what they're already being? Or is that, you know, a myth?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I can think of a couple of examples where editors have probably overcooked things a bit and, you know, turned up the volume too much. But I think there's no doubt that when Rupert's in town, it focuses the mind. It's no different from any other boss who's got the power to either laud you or sack you. You know, there's plenty of other industries where everybody jumps to a different beat when the big boss is in town. The thing about Rupert is his views as a person are so in line with the average punter. He actually has a pretty dim view of most politicians, and I would say that that puts him in line with about 99% of the public. You know, I think that all the stuff that's coming out of Canberra now is just, it's typical naval gazing Canberra gallery bullshit written by journos who are more interested in insider news that they can entertain each other with rather than providing stories that actually go to policy that directly affect people's lives.
That was David Pemberthy, the former editor of the Daily Telegraph, giving his usual frank assessment.
Kate McClymont here from the investigative team at The Herald. Much of what we do is giving a voice to the unheard and holding the powerful to account. Whether it's rampant underpayment in the fast food industry, sexual harassment in the entertainment world, or uncovering Australia's recycling crisis, our coverage proves the value of investigative journalism. Good reporting needs supporters. Subscribe today for just 50 cents a day. Just look for subscribe on any of our websites.
Now, changing tracks. As the House of Reps was preparing to adjourn on Monday night, Liberal MP Anne Sudmalis rose to deliver this scorching resignation.
I have asked the Prime Minister to acknowledge the withdrawal of my nomination for the seat of Gilmore. I want to make it abundantly clear my decision has nothing to do with the leadership of Scott. My decision does, however, have everything to do with the New South Wales State Division and their lack of action and the combined undermining actions as outlined by the revenge-motivated trifecta surrounding me locally. Who was this about? Certainly not the people who elected me. It was about ego-driven ambition, bullying and betrayal, and my local position is completely untenable.
That was quite a speech on Monday night from Anne Sudmalis.
That was like the tip of the iceberg on the frustrations within the Liberal Party, particularly among the women, about how the party's being run and the intimidation that does have an impact, the threats to pre-selections, the stacking of branches, the changeover that Anne Sudmalis saw in her local electorate where her enemies got the numbers and rolled some of her allies. There's this real frustration, and we're seeing the grassroots of the party going through a lot of grief at the moment, and it was a factor leading up to the leadership spill.
So what's the leadership of the party supposed to do about it? Because, you know, they come out and say things like, we support women, and you know, Scott Morrison tried to support a woman in the Wentworth pre-selection and says that he wants more women in his cabinet. But you did analysis this week, David, that showed that if things go the way they look like they're going, he's going to have five women in his party after the election.
Yeah, they've got a problem with the fact that there are now three women who are departing. There are also about three women who are extremely vulnerable in their seats because they hold marginal electorates, and the polls all show a swing towards Labor. That could leave the Liberals with one MP in the lower house in New South Wales and just one in the lower house in Victoria. It's really a danger sign, and I found it fascinating talking to Liberal MPs from the past who look at what happened in the 90s when there was a big influx of women into the party, and some of those lessons have been forgotten. Some of the things that were done in the 90s are not being done now, and that's making it very difficult for them to recruit female MPs.
So what did they do?
They mentored MPs. They had organisations that would help prepare female candidates for pre-selection processes. And in many cases, one of the reasons why Howard was able to get and hold government was that he had women in marginal electorates, Jackie Kelly in Western Sydney, Trish Worth in South Australia, other women around the place who helped him hold government. And they were recruited in some cases where Liberals went to them and said, we need you in the party and we need you to run for this seat.
So, Chris, we've seen all these women stand up and say that they're not going to cop the bullying. Is the bullying new, or is their willingness to stand up and say they're not going to cop it new?
Well, look, I think the culture of this place is pretty brutal. I think that, you know, there've been men who have certainly been bullied in this place. And, you know, during the course of that, and some of them are quite tragic stories, and you can't say too much without sort of identifying people. But, you know, like all places, like all workplaces, there are some men in here who have some mental problems, some history of that, and who suffered reoccurrences of that because of what was going on during the leadership spill. So it can be a really brutal and bruising place. I don't know how you remove that entirely. But look, how could you? I looked down from the press gallery during question time at the sea of blokes. There, less than one quarter of the coalition is now made up of women. And as David says, that's likely to drop. How could you, if you're on that front bench, stand up, turn around, and look at that and think that things are going well? As I've said to a couple of the people in the coalition, how do you breed without women? Really? Let's just look at this quite bluntly. And if your base, essentially, is ageing and skewing male, you have got to think about the future. You have got to think about making some significant change. And I think the only way, and this is entirely up to them, they say that this is not their nature, that the Labor Party killed quotas for them because they've got quotas. Well, they need to make a change. They need to make it soon. And it needs to be dramatic, because otherwise they're ruling themselves out of a future.
And the key thing is, it's not just about appealing to women voters and so forth. It's about electability for a government. If they want to hold government, they've got to fix it. If they want to, you know, if they lose government, then they'll have to make changes in order to regain it. It's absolutely essential for their survival.
And it's about good quality decision making. I mean, all the research in the corporate sector shows that, you know, companies that have gender equity in their senior management perform better because they make better decisions and they serve their customers better.
Getting back to that issue of the self-indulgence of the political class, always looking at their niche issues and getting obsessed with that in Canberra, if you have a greater diversity of MPs in your party room or caucus, I think it would make a difference, and it would curb some of that tendency to get obsessed with the minor issues.
And I've got to say, look, when I hear the argument, which is based on merit, like the people who got here were all meritorious, I think I look down at that group of people and I think, really? You know, I don't know how they judge themselves, and it might be harsh to judge them in this way, but there are a whole group of people down there that you would not feed that have essentially gotten to their positions because they know how to play a game within a political party. They're always talking about the fact that they're a bunch of hack Labor unionists on the other side. Well, look, there's a political class that has arisen in Australia which basically sees people go from, on both sides, from university into some kind of political job, either a union or in somebody's office, and then work their way up through the ranks. That is not a good gene pool. So they need to start expanding it.
So even assuming the Liberal Party can sort itself out on this, and of course it won't bring in quotas, but it might bring in a target, it might even bring in a hard target, how are they supposed to then encourage women to join in this process? Because you look at what's happened this year. I mean, look at what Michaela Cash said about those young women in Bill Shorten's office. Why would anyone say to their sister or daughter, look, politics is a good place for you?
So they have to demonstrate a change on the culture, because that's the only way in which they can start changing the way they appeal to women, not just as voters, but as potential candidates. They need more members in the Liberal Party. Look, the Labor Party needs more members as well, because otherwise they become a narrow group that is basically dominated by the unions. Without a wider membership, both these major parties have got a structural problem for the long term. So the Liberals, in particular, because of what they're going through at the moment, need a membership drive. They need a recruitment drive, which is the lesson from the 90s, a recruitment drive to get more women into the party and encourage them as candidates.
No, absolutely. It's got to start with the grassroots. You've got to make change there. I remember going to a Conservative conference in London and just being astounded, having been to the same things in Australia, at the number of young people that were there, young men and young women who'd gone along to a think tank to listen to, at that stage, it was our Prime Minister speak. And the difference was stark. You go to a Liberal Party conference in Australia and the demographic is reasonably elderly people, not even middle-aged, but older people. So, you know, if it's possible for the Conservatives in the UK to be able to scratch up a few young people, surely it must be. If their ideas are good enough, surely they'll drag people in. If they can't, then their ideas must be crap.
And is there any chance that the Liberals are going to sort this out before the next election? Because, you know, they're going to be fighting this election with a whole heap of women candidates probably in marginal seats.
No, I think they've run out of time. I don't think that they have the candidates now for some of those key seats. And as we saw with Ansud Marlis, she's likely to be replaced by a man, Grant Shultz. So that's already in train. It's too late to stop some of that. It's going to be very difficult for them. And given the polls, it means that they'll have time in opposition to think through these things.
Look, and I think that perhaps the best thing, and they wouldn't see it this way because they're trying now to save as much furniture as they can. I mean, that's why you go to someone who's supposed to appeal to the base. You're going to a person who is going to try and shore up as many seats as possible. Maybe that is Scott Morrison. But perhaps the best thing that could happen to the coalition would be to have a shocking defeat at the next election, to wipe the ground clear of what they've got at the moment, to have time to think about the future. And then there's space to put women into positions that they could win at an election afterwards and try and rebuild themselves. Sometimes a big defeat is not always the worst thing that can happen to a party, because the worst thing that happened to the coalition was, remember, after the Howard government was gone, for a long time we had this mantra of, essentially, you vote us back in, the Howard government is still here. It's just got, you know, most of the people are still around. We just haven't got John Howard or Peter Costello. What they should have been doing was thinking, okay, that was then, this is now. They've tried to, again, like the claw marks from the Howard government, sort of as they're dragged away from it. They need to start thinking about the future, not the past.
Chris and David, thanks so much for joining me on the first episode of Please Explain.
Thank you. Jory.
Please Explain is brought to you by The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald newsrooms. Support the work we do. Our subscribers get unlimited access to award-winning independent journalism, plus exclusive behind-the-scenes stories you can't get anywhere else. Follow the link in our show bio to subscribe today. This episode was produced by Rachel Dexter and David Escort, with technical assistance from David McMillan, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.